Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, December 15, 2017, during a live Courthouse Steps teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's teleforum conference call. This afternoon, we'll be hosting a Courthouse Steps conversation on Juliana v. United States. My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Jim May, who is a Distinguished Professor of Law at Widener University Delaware Law School, as well as Damian M. Schiff, who is a Senior Attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation. Our moderator today is Andy Varco, who is a partner at Boyden Gray & Associates PLLC. After our remarks from our speakers, we will move to an audience Q&A. So as they speak, please consider what questions you might have for them. Thank you all for speaking with us. Andy, the floor is now yours.
Thank you, Wesley. So just a word about our speakers. Damian Schiff is a very experienced environmental law and property rights lawyer who's been involved in a number of significant environmental law cases over the years, including the very important Sackett v. EPA case the Supreme Court decided 2012, and also including greenhouse gas emissions cases that have relevance to the Ninth Circuit case we're going to talk about today. Jim May has done a lot of different things in his career as a litigator and law professor, expert in international environmental law matters, constitutional law issues relating to environmental law. Founder of the Dignity Rights Project at Widener Law School, and in that connection, filed an amicus brief in the Juliana case on behalf of 65 law professors. He'll be talking about that during his portion of the discussion. I will now ask Damian to begin and give an overview of the case and Monday's oral argument and any initial observations he may want to offer on what the Court of Appeals is likely to do and where this very interesting and unusual case may be going.
Thank you very much, Andy, and thank you also to the Federalist Society for hosting today's teleforum. The Juliana case represents really just the latest in a longstanding effort to have the federal courts weigh in on how the nation will address climate change and what policies should be implemented in order to mitigate the harms from climate change. Really, the first case dealing with greenhouse gas regulation at the federal level, Massachusetts v. EPA, is, you could say, the seminal decision with respect to what federal courts will and will not do with greenhouse gas regulation. That case held that states had standing to sue the federal EPA for failing to adequately regulate greenhouse gas emissions for motor vehicles under the Clean Air Act. At that time, people thought, well, this might be the beginning of federal involvement in greenhouse gas regulation. And yet only a few years later, the Supreme Court ruled unanimously in American Electric Power Association versus Connecticut that basically the same types of plaintiffs, states and environmental groups and local governments, could not sue under federal common law to challenge the greenhouse gas emissions of various private energy companies. And with that decision, I think many in the environmental law community thought, well, perhaps this is really the end of greenhouse gas-related regulation at the federal level. And then we have filed in 2015 the Juliana case. The Juliana case filed on behalf of about 20 or 21, I don't recall offhand, miners, as well as an environmental group, challenging the federal government's failure to regulate or to encourage a fossil fuel greenhouse gas system that does not adequately take account of the impacts of greenhouse gas emissions. Basically saying over the last 50 years, the federal government has been remiss in failing to regulate itself and others in order to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, in order to reduce the threat of catastrophic climate change. The complaint asserts a number of claims, but the main gist is that under the Federal Due Process Clause, as well as a federal doctrine of the public trust, the federal government has this obligation that is runs to individual citizens to ensure that the government operates in a way that does not contribute to greenhouse gas emissions, or I should say does not contribute to catastrophic global warming. The Obama administration moved to dismiss the case shortly after the complaint was filed, and that motion to dismiss, somewhat surprisingly, I think many in the environmental law community would say, was denied by a federal district court in Oregon. Not only was it denied, but the district court also denied the federal government's request for an interlocutory appeal in order to raise the substantive issues of the complaint to the Ninth Circuit without having to go to summary judgment, to discovery, and to trial. When that interlocutory appeal request was denied, and with the change of administration, the federal government then decided earlier this year to seek mandamus relief from the Ninth Circuit, arguing that essentially the district court had gone off the rails in allowing this case to proceed to discovery, and that by doing so, the district court had raised the specter of a constitutional crisis between the executive and the judicial branches in potentially adjudicating the claims that the plaintiff children here have raised. Now, what are those concerns? Well, specifically, standing and the merits. With respect to standing, the federal government argues that that the harm of climate change is a type of generalized, diffuse grievance that is not well suited to federal court adjudication. Typically, for standing, you need to have a discrete, concrete, personal injury, and yet the injuries that the individual children here complain of are really indistinguishable from the injuries that any of us will experience as a result of climate change. And so the federal government argues that there really is no injury appropriate for a case or controversy in under Article 3 in federal courts. Moreover, the federal government argues that you really can't pin global climate change on any one set of emissions, that the federal government isn't responsible, certainly for emissions that come from China or India or other parts of the world, but even so, isn't entirely responsible for all the emissions even from the United States. And without that sort of causal link, you can't establish standing either. And lastly, the federal government argues that there's really no redress that could be offered. It would be constitutionally suspect if a federal district court were to, say, order the President of the United States to enter into various international treaties in order to reduce global emissions that would then have a substantive impact on the threat of global warming. So that's basically the standing argument. On the merits, relatedly, the federal government argues that there really can't be any due process right, as the district court found, to a climate system capable of sustaining human life. That sort of fundamental due process right not only doesn't have much basis in the original understanding of the Due Process Clause, but also it doesn't really have any limiting principle, that if you find a fundamental right to a healthy environment, then why not a fundamental right to so many other things that are important for human flourishing, that the federal courts nevertheless have not allowed to go forward. And with respect to the public trust doctrine, similarly, that's a doctrine the federal government argues is basically a state law issue. It's not something that federal courts typically concern themselves with. And even if they were to, it's not something that typically extends to air issues. It's usually a water-based doctrine. Anyway, at the oral argument, perhaps not surprisingly, the panel expressed a lot of concern, not so much with the merits of the plaintiff's claims, but a lot of concern with the posture in which the issue had been raised, that is mandamus. Typically, mandamus is reserved for those extraordinary situations where something has really gone wrong in the lower court, and unless there's immediate appellate intervention, one of the parties is going to be irreparably harmed. Judge Berzon, one of the panel members, specifically mentioned that there was no pressing harm here. There wasn't, say, an order from the district court or from the magistrate judge directing the deposition of the president or requiring the release of classified information or any other immediate threat. And basically her position was, if and when that happens, then you can seek review of that. But right now, the concern about a collision course between the executive and judicial departments is speculative. And to some extent, Chief Judge Thomas, the second panelist member, I think agreed with that and argued that if mandamus is proper just because the district court makes the wrong ruling on standing, for example, or makes the wrong ruling on finding a new cause of action, then wouldn't that mean that mandamus would be regularly available? Because those types of errors happen quite often. They're usually corrected on appeal after final judgment, but they're typically not corrected in mandamus. Lastly, Judge Kaczynski, I think, was the only panelist at the argument who expressed any sort of concern with the case going forward in the district court and expressed really any, I think, solicitude with the federal government's position that mandamus would be appropriate here. And I think his questions showed that he had serious concerns with whether the plaintiffs could ever establish standing or, for that matter, a cause of action, whether there was, in fact, a fundamental due process right to a world climate that could sustain human life. I think his extreme skepticism was not necessarily shared by the other panel members. And so reading the tea leaves, one might not be surprised at all by a decision, say 2-1, arguing that even if on the merits these claims may be questionable, at this point there isn't enough harm to the federal government to justify the extraordinary remedy of mandamus relief. My own view on, in particular, the merits of this case is that I think in some respects the way the claims themselves have been framed are framed in such a way as to confuse the issue of standing. And what I mean by that is if you posit that there is a fundamental due process right to a climate that is capable of sustaining human life, then it should naturally follow that if the government you allege is not doing what's necessary in order to sustain climate-friendly system, then that is an injury that could be redressed by an order telling the government that, yes, you have to do that. But you could, say, repackage other types of injuries that clearly are not within Article III's case or controversy clause that nevertheless would fit into that framework. So, for example, you could say, I have a fundamental due process right as a citizen to ensure that the federal government obeys the laws that are enacted by Congress, and thus when an agency fails to abide by the law, my fundamental due process right as a citizen has been violated. Well, that would seem to get around the standing problem, and yet effectively what you've done there is to say that there is citizen standing. And you could do the same hypothetical with taxpayer standing or other types of standing that the Supreme Court has definitively rejected as a basis for standing in federal court. So I think that's really kind of the problem here, why things have been confused, because the claims have been framed in such a way as if accepted on the merits, effectively do away with what otherwise would be pertinent standing limitations. And my last point before we turn it over for Professor May's views is on the merits themselves. Is there a fundamental due process right to a climate that can sustain life? I mean, in some respects, that seems attractive, because if the government is not helping to ensure that human life can exist, then presumably that's about as threatening as anything else the government can do. And yet, I think one serious concern with that methodology is, where is the limiting principle? One could say, well, isn't a basic income essential to human dignity? Isn't education essential to human dignity? Isn't health care essential to human dignity and flourishing? And so I think you could easily come up with all sorts of things that then the federal government would have to provide or either regulate with an eye towards providing under the aegis of the Due Process Clause that traditionally federal courts have been reluctant to do. And lastly, and this is something that Judge Kaczynski raised in his questioning, there seems something a little peculiar with using a lawsuit brought on behalf of just a dozen and a half children represented by three or four lawyers that then is the basis upon which the country develops, in cooperation with one federal district court judge in Oregon, its national program for greenhouse gas regulation. That now basically all of these incredibly contentious issues that have been debated in Congress and have been debated in state legislatures for over a decade are now going to be resolved by a few plaintiff's attorneys in conjunction with one federal district court judge coming up with a plan. That seems just a little awkward, and I think that regardless of how the actual doctrines play out, stepping back a little bit and looking at it in those terms, I think does give one a little pause as to whether the federal courts really are an appropriate vehicle for addressing these types of issues. And so I look forward to our further discussion and questions from the audience, and I'll hand it back over to Andy.
Thank you, Damian, for that excellent summary and very thoughtful observations. I'll now ask Jim May to supplement, respond, offer his own thoughts.
Thank you very much. And Damian, that was a terrific job of providing an overview about what this case is about and the issues raised before the court. And let me thank the Federal Society and those of you who are spending your time with us. So I'll offer some views as well, but the opening view is that really what this case is about the authority of federal courts to say what the law means, something that was addressed and at issue in Marbury versus Madison more than 200 years ago. So, you know, what comes around goes around, and arguably it's the most important environmental case in the United States, if not the world, because it touches and concerns so many issues that Damian was pointing out, so many substantive questions, so many procedural issues, and then these core separation of powers questions. And so in my view, the Giuliani case is about much more than children's rights or even climate change. It's about the power of the executive to constrain the ability of an independent judiciary to perform its core constitutional function. And at bottom, the case concerns the relevance of the Constitution for present and future generations and for the human dignity components that were discussed most recently in the Obergefell decision. So the government defendants believe that the Constitution, at least the way that I heard what the positions were on the 11th, is that the Constitution is sort of irrelevant, if not invisible, to climate change. That's sort of my opening thoughts about the case, and who knows where it's going to go exactly. But getting to the end first, it felt as though that the court by 2-1 would deny the government's motion to grant the writ of mandamus, so and allow the case to continue. That doesn't mean the plaintiffs win. That doesn't mean that all the issues that are litigated will be litigated, or all the issues in the complaint will be litigated, but it just means the case continues and the plaintiffs get their day in court. So I'll address six quick topics in about 10 minutes and provide some commentary along the way. And they're as follows. Standard of review first, separation of powers second, and then the merits on due process and public trust doctrine, and then procedural questions on standing and political question. So here goes. So first is on the standard of review. So the first thing, in my view anyway, and the most important aspect of this case is the standard of review. It's on writ of mandamus, which as Damian pointed out, is an extraordinary writ. It just boils down to whether the Court of Appeals believes that the lower court, as Damien mentioned, went off the rails, and the standard of review is clear error, whether the lower court committed clear error. And as far as I can tell, this appears to be the most deferential civil standard of review in law. It's more deferential to lower court than a clearly erroneous standard of review or arbitrary and capricious or substantial evidence, and so on. So the government's burden is very very high. And there, as was discussed during oral argument, there's very little precedent where a court of appeals or a Supreme Court has invoked or has found the standard to be met, beginning with Marbury versus Madison. And when it's invoked, and it's almost exclusively regarding discovery requests that are in tension with the First Amendment or privileges under Rule 26. So there's no precedent invoking the standard as it's the government is asking it to be applied here, which counsel for the government admitted during an oral argument. That doesn't mean it couldn't be invoked, but there's just very little to go on. So that's first. The second is about separation of powers. In my view, the government's concerns about separation of powers, I mean, I think they're certainly relevant, but they're overwrought and based really upon two fundamental errors. First, the government's position makes the misplaced argument that it's erroneous for a federal court to consider tough cases involving the government. So if they involve the government, if they might infringe upon the actions of the executive, that federal courts shouldn't get involved. And in my view, that's just fundamentally wrong. Second, the government's position ignores kind of core federal jurisdiction functions of a trial court to determine not just whether the claims are meritorious, but also to manage the case. That's what trial courts do. And so in this case, the plaintiffs have filed a complaint about 2 years ago, and about a year ago, the lower court found that they had raised colorable causes of action, so under Rule 12b. So we're not at the summary judgment phase. We're not at the trial phase. It's just whether the case can go forward. So, again, in my view, the defendants misapprehend the role of federal courts in confusing sort of disappointment with clear error. And as Judge Thomas raised concerns during the oral arguments about if it's clear error for the district court to have allowed the case just to go forward at this stage, then it would potentially open up the floodgates for every single disappointed litigant in every case across the country and open up the door to filing writs of mandamus if they're unhappy. And there were concerns raised about that process. There's a normal course. There are motions, there are determinations, there are orders, there are discovery orders, there are decisions, and that the writ, if it's to be invoked, if it's relevant, it's at that point. And ultimately, appeal is the way for defendants to go to get the case to the Ninth Circuit, not on mandamus now. So that's just a thought. But every case, the sense that I got from the oral argument is that every case involves a controversy, and many of them are tough, and that's what makes them cases. And that every federal case involving the federal government implicates separation of powers, and that's why powers are separated. So the Ninth Circuit, at least two members of the Ninth Circuit, seem to be concerned about the implications of the government's argument. So third is third and fourth are about the merits. That's about the Fifth Amendment claim, and then also about the public trust doctrine, both of which the plaintiffs have invoked. So as Damien mentioned, the first aspect there is that the plaintiffs argue that there's an unenumerated fundamental right under the Fifth Amendment to a stable climate. And so the question is whether the Fifth Amendment can accommodate that kind of a claim. And it's also unprecedented. There isn't yet a federal court in the United States that has recognized that claim, not at the district court level until this case, and not at the Court of Appeals level, and obviously not at the U.S. Supreme Court. So the Fifth Amendment provides that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. So this is a substantive due process claim, not a procedural due process claim. And the plaintiffs argue that, again, the Fifth Amendment can accommodate this kind of a fundamental right, and that it's consistent with prior fundamental rights that have been recognized by the U.S. Supreme Court, and those include the right to direct the education and upbringing of one's children, procreation, bodily integrity, contraception, sexual intimacy, family, marriage, and most recently in the Obergefell decision, and even against grossly excessive punitive damages. So the due process clause and the substantive due process aspect of the due process clause has been open and viewed to be sort of tolerant of certain kinds of claims, but limited still. And that limitation asks whether the claim that's being pursued is fundamental in our system of governance and essential to ordered liberty. So it's sort of those two separate questions. And so the federal government argues that under the Glucksberg decision, that a right to a stable climate satisfies neither of those. And obviously the plaintiffs argue on the other side of things. So we'll see. So the next part concerns the public trust doctrine. That's the other merits-based claim. And just very briefly, the plaintiffs argue that the federal government has a duty of holding the atmosphere in trust for present and future generations. Again, as Damian mentioned, that's a doctrine that has largely been limited to claims brought under state common law, A, and B, claims involving water. So this would push that doctrine to in the province of federal common law and into a different arena. So there are the pushback on that most recently is from the U.S. Supreme Court in a case that wasn't invoked during oral argument, but is the American Electric Power case where the Supreme Court found that federal causes of action or certain kinds of common law causes of action are displaced by federal activity, sort of preemption at the federal level. So that would be something to contend with regarding that claim. And the next part is about, the last part, and I'm just wrapping up here. I'm about 8.5 minutes, so I have 2 minutes to go here, is standing and political question doctrine. So on the standing claim, this drew more heat than honestly I thought that it might from the panel where particularly Judge Kaczynski felt that the plaintiffs were on very thin ice under another Ninth Circuit opinion in a case involving climate change, the Bellin case, where the Ninth Circuit dismissed a claim on standing ground where the public interest litigants tried to invoke the same sort of special solicitude that the Supreme Court recognized in the Massachusetts decision, and the Ninth Circuit said, no, you can't. You don't get that special solicitude, A, and B, you haven't demonstrated adequate traceability, really, demonstrate standing because the amount of greenhouse gas emissions that were involved with the defendants in that case was so small. So the plaintiffs in this case argue that there's a lot more at stake, and so the outcome in Bellin would be different here than in the outcome in Bellin. That's A and B, that Bellin was at the summary judgment phase after the plaintiffs had conducted discovery, and in this case the plaintiffs haven't yet been able to do that. So the outcome would be different. And then very last, wrapping up in a few seconds, is the political question doctrine, which wasn't discussed much at all, not by name, but sort of inferentially under the separation of powers issues that were raised earlier. The federal defendants, beginning with the Obama administration, argued that federal courts shouldn't be involved because these are matters that really are consigned to the elected branches and the federal courts shouldn't enter the thicket. At least two of the judges didn't seem to be skeptical about whether a lower court could actually consider these matters. It seemed to be skeptical about applying it, in essence, the principles of the political question doctrine because there isn't a textual or prudential commitment to a court and branch of government. But again, Judge Kaczynski seemed to be concerned about entering the thicket here. And that's on the one hand. On the other hand, when he was having a conversation with the advocate for the plaintiffs on the 11th, during an oral argument, he seemed to be very confused about what Baker versus Carr stood for, which is the leading case on political question doctrine. So that's my very quick wrap-up of the six questions, and now I'm at 11 minutes, so I apologize for going over a minute. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim, for your comments and great observations. So before we turn it over to Q&A, I have a couple questions for Damian and Jim. Here's one. Judge Berzon, who was, I think all of the judges in the argument's fun to listen to, it's education or watch, because the Ninth Circuit now video streams and archives videos of arguments. It's a fun and educational argument to listen to, and all the judges were seemingly highly prepared. It was a special sitting. Judge Berzon seemed to strongly encourage the plaintiffs to narrow their case if it proceeds, if mandamus is denied. I guess first Damien and then Jim, what are your thoughts on how the plaintiffs could do that? What might they do, which I think would make it much more likely that the case would not be short-circuited a little later on?
Well, Andy, I'll start off on that. I did note in particular at one point Judge Berzon said that, quote, there's no refinement here, all a big mush. And I think that is consistent with her approach to the case as revealed by her questions. And it's understandable that as a case goes on through trial court litigation that it's going to be narrowed. But there are some concerns with this case that I think might not otherwise be present with narrowing. You know, one of the concerns is that as it's related to what Jim just mentioned about standing and trying to distinguish this case from the Ninth Circuit precedent in Bellin that said that environmental groups couldn't sue refineries in the state of Washington for greenhouse gas-related issues under the Clean Air Act because the amount of emissions that they were contributing were de minimis in relation to the global problem of climate change. Now, Professor May was right that at oral argument, the counsel for the plaintiffs said, well, wait a second, you know, we're suing here enough federal agencies that we've got 16 to 25% of global emissions. But that's only because they're suing everyone. And if they were to respond to Judge Berzon and start narrowing things down, I think inevitably you get into the concern that led the court in the Ninth Circuit in Bellin to dismiss that action, that part of their theory of standing depends precisely upon having a very, very broad collection of defendants who individually are not responsible for a significant amount of emissions, but only when they are all combined. I mean, that's one concern. Another concern, you know, at one point Judge Berzon said, well, in sort of defending the plaintiff's case against some pretty tough questioning from Judge Kaczynski, she said, well, you know, it may be true that due process might not require the federal government to go out and try to regulate other private parties to prevent them from emitting greenhouse gases. But don't forget that the federal government owns a lot of land. And surely the government has a duty with respect to other citizens in how it uses its own federal lands and oil and gas and what have you. Now, again, the problem with that sort of narrowing is that then starts to look an awful lot like a nuisance claim. That the plaintiffs are saying, well, the feds are misusing their property. They're allowing all of these emissions to be created through oil and gas and what have you, and that's hurting the climate. Well, that is essentially a public nuisance air type claim that the Supreme Court in the American Electric Power case said precisely doesn't exist, at least not at the federal level. So I do share, I do think that there is some concern in whether the plaintiffs could actually adequately narrow their case and still keep it viable.
Okay, would you like me to respond to that?
That'd be great.
Okay, yeah, I think I agree with just about, or I see it the same way, just about every way that Damien did. A couple of things that I might add to that is that, you know, the court invited the plaintiffs to narrow their case, and I think that sort of goes without saying. That's what happens in discovery. You know, those people of us and others who have been involved in litigation, that's what you do. So the plaintiffs filed a complaint initially, then they amended their complaint, and then over the process of discovery, they'll find out more about whether they can support certain claims or not, or whether there are additional claims. So the purpose of narrowing would be perhaps, as Damien mentioned, to limit activity to those that occur on federal lands. It could be about specific actions taken by the government or not taken. It could be to limit it to specific federal agencies. But the takeaway point that I took anyway from that line of questioning is that that's the purpose of the civil dispute system is to narrow issues. And the one part that concerned me about standing and also about narrowing along the way was an exchange. I don't know if folks caught it, but an exchange between Judge Kaczynski and the and Julia Olson, who was arguing the case for the plaintiffs, where it was about discovery, about what would be limiting on discovery and what might be discovered. And the plaintiffs' counsel was trying to make the point that the discovery process would enable the plaintiffs to make the case more efficient and address many of the concerns, perhaps even including separation of powers concerns that were being raised. And a means by which to do that is by sending a 30B6 request. And and Judge Kaczynski didn't know what that was. So that just made me wonder about the extent to which there was appreciation of the role of discovery in the process of narrowing the case.
And a kind of follow-on question that, Jim, if you could initially address, and then Damian, if you have thoughts. The prior administration, in answering the complaint, made a number of admissions. Before the district court, a fair amount of the discovery initially was directed to industry interveners who are no longer in the case anymore. And my recollection of the Ninth Circuit argument Monday was that there was some discussion of how discovery would be much more manageable and limited precisely because the industry intervener parties are no longer in the case. A lot of the fact issues that had been disputed by them and their answer to the complaint are no longer at issue because of DOJ's admissions and its answer. And so that does lead me to a question about what will the trial be about? What remaining main issues are in dispute?
That again gets back to the purpose of discovery. There'll be some of the claims that were made by the plaintiffs, they might want to drop, others they might want to pursue harder, others they might want to reshape. But that was a huge development in this case, where, as you mentioned, the industry interveners dropped out of the case. And so what's left is the answers to the complaint with some admissions there. But on the discovery side of it, what's still left to be determined is the extent to which, I mean, a couple of things, the extent to which the government knew about the effects of climate change, and also about the adverse effects of climate change going forward, and lastly, about what can be done about it. So that can happen through the discovery process and really in a civil dispute. That's the best way of getting admissions through Rule 36 and conducting depositions and getting answers from the defendants. And at the end of the day, that, again, doesn't presume that the plaintiffs have met their burden of proof on the merits, but it puts them in position to try to prove their case.
And I would only add to that I think it unlikely that the current administration would want to try and retract to any extent the admissions made by the answer of the prior administration, in part because, as demonstrated through the mandamus briefing here, those facts aren't necessary to whether the case should be dismissed anyway or whether mandamus relief is appropriate here. That even assuming all of the basic science of climate change, which I take to have been admitted by the answer, you still have the same jurisprudential separation of powers and constitutional law concerns that one could conclude are strong enough to merit dismissal of the action without at the same time gainsaying any of the science that undergirds the climate change debate.
And before we open it up for Q&A, a final question I have, and I think again I'll ask Jim to respond first and then Damian to offer any additional observations. Climate change is an international phenomenon. There are other legal proceedings and activities going on all over the world with regard to climate change and attempts to mitigate and prevent it. Jim, just if you could give a brief overview of some of those activities and how this suit might have some sort of impact, indirectly or otherwise?
Sure. The bottom line is the world is watching. So there are climate change cases, not exactly like this, because we, you know, our constitution is unique. But there are climate change cases being brought against national governments all around the globe. There are about a half a dozen ones that are more notable, if you will, principally out of the Netherlands and Norway, India, Pakistan, and elsewhere. And there are also, you know, this, in, under some constitutional systems, some constitutions from other countries specifically require that the government develop policies and action plans for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. So overall, the world is watching what happens in this case, and not just the world, but other litigants as well. So this is one case in one federal district court in Oregon. So there are 94 federal district courts. There are other kinds of claims and causes of action that could be pursued potentially, including against the federal government, maybe that weren't pursued by the plaintiffs here. So if the case is, if the case continues, one can imagine that there will be other cases pursued elsewhere. And then also at the state level, arguably if the case continues here, that would provide a basis for reconsidering and or taking a second and third look at constitutional provisions at the subnational level to enforce those. So 50 states, six of them, have a fundamental right to a healthy environment, and two of them include or require the state government to hold the atmosphere, if you will, in trust for present and future generations. So if this case goes forward at the federal level, it could inform or inspire, if you will, or influence cases all around the globe, federally and also at the subnational level.
And I would add, in particular, with respect to state law litigation, there is already here in California public nuisance and related tort actions that have been brought against the dozen or so largest energy companies in the world by the city of San Francisco and several other coastal local governments in California, basically using the same theories of liability for greenhouse gas emissions and seeking damages. And so I think that however the Giuliana case it ultimately is disposed of, I think there will be effects, as Jim suggests, both within this country at the state level and also internationally. There is one concern, though, that the very fact that there are other countries that are concerned about the same issue and that are invoking their political and judicial branches to address it does give some support to the government's position in this case that ultimately an effective remedy is going to require international cooperation. And that is something that our judicial system, the federal level in particular, has been reluctant to do, or reluctant to require the executive branch to do for the country as a whole. So there is that if you want to call it a paradoxical concern, that the very fact that internationally people are watching is in a sense a reason perhaps why they should not be why the case shouldn't proceed in federal court, but rather should be left to the politically accountable branches for resolution.
Yeah, and just a quick response to that is, you know, again, all of this is it's super complicated. You know, the best way to address climate change, who knows? But at the international level, it is a paradox for the Trump administration, you know, in court in the Ninth Circuit to argue that, in essence, that climate change is a global phenomenon, and it's a shared responsibility among all countries across the planet on the one hand. And so, therefore, the federal courts shouldn't get involved, but on the other hand, be the only country now, the only country on the planet that has elected not to engage in a global conversation about ways to reduce greenhouse gas emissions at the treaty level.
Thanks to you both. I think I'll now ask Wesley to open the call for our listeners.
Wonderful. Let's move to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter the star key and then the pound key on your telephone. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We'll answer questions in the order in which they are received. The audience queue is still open. Andy, are there any other questions that you'd like to ask our panelists?
Sure, I do. And first, just an observation. I feel I'd be a little remiss if I didn't mention some recent news developments that may have some bearing on this matter. But yesterday, Chief Judge Thomas, who was on the panel in this matter, issued an order, which is available on the Ninth Circuit's website, identifying a complaint against Judge Kaczynski, also on the panel, based on accounts of alleged serious improper conduct contained in a recent Washington Post article and any other related articles, and that order initiates an inquiry concerning those accounts and requests that the Chief Justice of the United States transfer the complaint to a judicial council of another circuit. We're not equipped here to focus on that topic, but given the intense media scrutiny that's arisen since last week, I think I'd be remiss not to note it. One question I have is, and I think, Jim, because you're more aligned with the plaintiffs, I think you'd be the good person to briefly address it, is just, let's say you're a judge who doesn't really agree with Obergefell or thinks it shouldn't be extended. Is there still a way to concluding that the plaintiffs have a viable due process claim here?
I think that there is. So in Obergefell, the court found that the due process clause was capacious enough to protect a right to same-sex marriage as an extension of the human dignity aspects protected by liberty interests under the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendment. So here, I think that even ignoring or turning one's back on that particular aspect of Obergefell, a court could find, judges could find that a stable climate a right to a stable climate is deeply rooted in the nation's jurisprudence, A, and fundamental to ordered liberty, B. What Judge Aiken wrote in her opinion at the district court level in this case a year ago was essentially finding that a right to a stable climate, a stable climate is so inextricably intertwined with a right to live, with liberty, with holding a job, with being healthy, with raising your family, with being a property owner, that it's protected under the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendment. So I think a court could distance itself from the rationale used in Obergefell and still land in the same place.
Wonderful. It looks like we do have one question in the audience queue. Let's go ahead and move to our first caller. Hello, caller.
I'd like to ask about separation of powers, just this point, please. When I would have thought that this case could never make it past the barrier of the political question, but you seem to say that's not such an issue. Could you cite a couple of precedents that will enlighten me on that?
For me or for Jim or for Damien?
Anyone.
Damien, would you like to take that or like me
too?
Well,
I can certainly. Baker v. Carr, I think we've already discussed, is one of the leading public political question precedents of the Supreme Court, and I think the gist of the theory is that there are some issues that just don't lend themselves to judicial resolution because they would require the court to essentially take on roles that are constitutionally and as a practical matter, otherwise committed to the other branches. Now, it's interesting, there is a precedent applying the political question doctrine adverse to environmental claims concerning greenhouse gases, and that is the district court decision in Comer, which is I'm sorry, not in Comer, the district court decision in American Electric Power versus Connecticut, the case that we talked about earlier, the Supreme Court ultimately held there is no federal common law of public nuisance that applies to greenhouse gases. The original district court decision in that case did say that even if there were otherwise such a tort theory available, that the political question doctrine would preclude a federal court from entertaining it because the remedy of such a claim is too bound up with political questions about what is the reasonable amount of greenhouse gas emissions that we should allow, to what extent do we need to conclude international agreements in order to effectively deal with global climate change. Now, that part of the district court decision never got up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court on displacement grounds ruled that there was no claim. But there is that precedent, and so I do think going forward that may be an obstacle. And it is, as I mentioned earlier in the call, I think a serious one when you consider that this is ultimately a global problem, that the United States cannot solve the problem on its own, and thus international action is necessary. And yet that is precisely the sort of thing that the federal judiciary has been reluctant to order the executive branch to become involved in.
Yes, I don't see how they could order. Yes, thank you.
Well, if I could throw in a little bit about the political question doctrine, the headline is it's hardly ever invoked. It's invoked. It's hardly ever implemented or found to exist to prevent a federal court from considering claims that are otherwise legally cognizable. So the two things. First, it's a doctrine. It's not textual. So there's nothing in the Constitution that specifically forbids or prohibits a federal court from getting involved in matters that are political, if you will. In fact, arguably under Article 3, it's just the opposite. But to the extent that the doctrine has been invoked, as I said, it's been invoked in very limited circumstances, but the court has developed six formulations, they call it, and it gets into the thicket about a doctrine that involves thicket. But first is if there's a textual commitment to a coordinate branch of government, then courts won't get involved. Like the qualifications clause, the court has said, or about impeachment, which is a two-part process that's in the House and the Senate under Article 1. And then there are five other prudential formulations where the Supreme Court has said, hey, you know, if our getting involved would, for example, result in sort of extreme embarrassment or inconsistency with executive policies in ways where federal courts shouldn't get involved, then we won't, like with foreign affairs in federalism, like with redistricting. So the cases there include like Baker versus Carr, the impeachment case is Nixon versus United States. The foreign matters case involves the Reagan administration. You can Google it and find it easily enough. I forget the full name of it, sorry. And the other one is about recognizing state governments, which is the Colgrove decision. So there's a body of cases that involve a doctrine. And the last word on that is that the doctrine is very controversial because of, again, this atextual nature of it. Thank you.
You say it's rarely invoked, but I think it's routinely invoked in war powers cases. I'm a plaintiff right at the moment, Maxwell v. President of the U.S., and I've already been told political question will probably be the barrier. So at the district court level, it is used.
Well, thank you, caller, for your question. It looks like the queue is now open. Andy, in the meantime, would you like to ask anything else? Oh, it looks like we do have another audience question. Let's move to that person.
My name is Carolyn Carlotto. I have been an attorney for over 40 years, but I'm not a trial attorney. And my question may mean that all this would need to be answered factually on appeal. But it seems to me that this whole lawsuit is so incomprehensibly broad. It's asking the federal government to do things that no one knows how to do on a problem that no one has actually, no matter everybody says, oh, you know, the science is sound. Well, nobody understands how climate works. Nobody is entirely clear the mechanisms that it may affect global change. Nobody knows for sure, you know, what parts of it are caused by human beings and what parts are just natural. So, I mean, when is a question just too fuzzy and too large to be entertained? It's like somebody suing to say the government is not protecting us against alien invasion, and they have a duty to protect every citizen from having a spacecraft land in their yard. To me, it just seems kind of crazy.
Well, I can answer that first. I mean, I think to some extent, because the answer filed by the prior administration admits some of the basic elements of the science of climate change, some of that concern, unless those admissions are revoked, are answered. But I do think the caller is correct that there is something about the theory of this lawsuit that just seems to be asking a little too much. As I mentioned earlier, it does seem strange that something as significant and as controversial as how to address climate change would ultimately be decided in negotiations between a few plaintiffs' attorneys and a district court in Oregon, producing a plan or approving a plan that would then direct all federal actions with respect to addressing climate change. It just seems a little too ambitious, and obviously not too ambitious to have led the district court to dismiss the case. But I think ultimately that is a practical concern that maybe this case has just been framed in such a way that our judicial system is not geared to responding to it appropriately.
Yeah, if I could weigh in just a little bit on that, about it being incomprehensibly broad and how no one knows anything for sure. I don't pretend to know everything about climate change or effects, and so take this answer for what it's worth. But in under our civil system, that's a purpose, not the whole purpose, but that's a purpose of filing an action and allowing the plaintiffs to have their day in court and to engage in discovery along the way. The questioner may be entirely correct that no one knows for sure, and lines can't be drawn between human activity and human effects on other humans. But the plaintiff's point of view here is that they should be given an opportunity to try to prove their case. So I think that remains to be seen. The last thing I'll say in response to that question, if I could, is that the plaintiffs are also arguing this very basic idea that kids have a seat at the table. You know, it's a case brought on behalf of present and future generations, and the Trump administration's position is that those children and their voices and their concerns and their hopes and their dreams and aspirations don't matter. So that's the other side of it as well. If not at the international level, then let's clean up our own house and allow federal courts to provide their constitutionally devoted role to, among other things, overseeing actions or inactions by the executive office.
Thank you, caller, for your question. The queue is now open. But it looks like we're at the end of our hour. Andy, is there any question that you'd like to ask before we finish, or should we turn to closing remarks?
I think we can turn to closing remarks. Thank you.
Thank you. Damien, would you like to start us off?
Sure. I want to thank, again, the Federal Society for hosting the Teleforum this afternoon, and Andy for moderating, and Jim for representing the other side of these issues. My closing remark is essentially an echo of what I had mentioned earlier, that the case law seems to be going in a certain direction at the federal level, and that is that greenhouse gas issues are sui generis. And I think 20 years from now, we'll look back and see Mass v. EPA as maybe the high watermark of the efforts to enlist the federal judiciary in greenhouse gas-related issues. And I suspect that ultimately the Giuliani case and cases like it will not proceed, will not be successful in federal court. Now, whether this particular mandamus petition will be granted, I think ultimately that's going to turn upon whether the Ninth Circuit or the Supreme Court, if it gets involved, says, look, we know there's going to be a problem ultimately. We know there's going to be an objectionable discovery order. We know there's going to be a conflict between the branches. Do we have to wait until the inevitable happens in order for us to just stop this now? And you could say, well, why not? I mean, if it hasn't happened yet, then why should we anticipate it? And I think that ultimately, if the Ninth Circuit or the Supreme Court puts a stop on the case now, I think the rationale will be this is sui generis. This is not only unprecedented in terms of the merits, but it's sui generis in that climate change is a sui generis problem. And I suspect that will ultimately be how the case will be disposed of.
Yeah, and just for, again, just for what it's worth, prognosticating is always dangerous business, and I don't pretend to know how the case will turn out, but what one observes from the history of American jurisprudence is that there's always a first time. We didn't have First Amendment jurisprudence until just 100 years ago, beginning with clear and present danger cases, and now I teach an entire course on it with, you know, literally thousands of cases invoked. But it all started with one case. The separate but equal doctrine began with one case. Brown versus Board of Education is one case. Cases involving the rights to marry, you know, again, procreation, reproductive rights, the rights to use contraceptives, the right to send your kids to public school to learn different languages, the right to be compensated justly for taking of property and how that would be done. Those the first cases of those that reach the higher branches of the federal courts, in virtually every single case, federal defendants or other defendants were saying they're unprecedented, they're beyond the reach of the courts, the courts shouldn't get involved, these are political, you know, in essence, but through different constructs, the same kind of defense is here. So this is the first of what could be many, and others to follow. And again, without commenting on who should win on the merits of it, it's certainly within the, in my view anyway, within the province of the role that federal courts play in trying to work through some of these very nettlesome and complicated questions. That's what courts are there for.
Well, on behalf of the Federal Society, I'd like to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome all listener feedback by email info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. This call is now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.